Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
There are questions that I have had for over 50 years, and I have never yet found the answers. I have looked through the Bible, and throughout all of its pages, I haven't been able to even get a clue as to what the correct answer to some of those questions are. And I suspect that many of you have questions too. Have you ever wondered if God is omnipotent, that is, if he has all power? Why did he take 6 days to create everything that exists? Why not just, as he created light, speak the words, "Let there be light," and there is light, just like that? Why not do all of that for all of creation? And you can probably think of a host of other questions, maybe like this one, for instance. If God is perfect, why did he make such an imperfect creation? And as it's indicated by the rise of Satan, the arch enemy of God, if I could use those words to describe an enemy of God, also manifested by the fall of man, the universal destruction, in whose nostrils is the breath of life when the global flood took place. And then, finally, the slaying of God's own Son on the cross. And while you chew on that, ponder the answer to another similar question, that if God is a loving God, why does he allow suffering in the world? And then require everyone to do what he says. And finally, send the disobedient to burn forever in hell.
Well,
a lot of people struggle with these kinds of questions, and even believers find them quite troubling. But another question that is perhaps equally important to all of these, for all of us with limited understanding and limited time to decipher the answers to these kinds of questions, would be, how important are these answers really? You may not immediately see the connection, but the answers to these questions that I've listed, and many others, might be seen through what Jesus did to a blind man in John chapter 9. Most of our lesson tonight will come from that section of Scripture, but let's begin in verses 6 and 7 that reads, "When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and he said to him, 'Go wash in the pool of Siloam,' which is translated 'sent.' So he went and washed and came back seeing." I wonder if the expression, "here's mud in your eye," has anything to do with what took place with the healing of that blind man. But in case you're wondering, caking mud in a blind man's eyes is not the prescribed treatment for healing blindness. Modern science and medicine has come up with a lot better ways, and there have been a few cases of people even having been born blind that have been healed. But the setting for this event offers additional understanding to help us recognize how spectacular this event really was at the time. The setting for the event, beginning back in John chapter 7 and going all the way through John chapter 10, records events in a chronological fashion. Jesus traveled to Jerusalem in John chapter 7 to celebrate the festival of booths. And as he is performing miracles in 2 chapters before he healed the blind man, he is joined by thousands of people who came to Jerusalem to celebrate with the rest of their Israelite brothers and sisters, and they're watching Jesus perform miracles one after another. And that would have been, of course, the worst possible time to send a blind man to find his way to the pool of Siloam. He would have had to navigate through all of the crowds with all of those people having come to Jerusalem to find his way to the pool. And you can imagine a blind man bumping into one person after another while simultaneously traversing numerous steps that led down a steep hill to the Pool of Siloam, he may have fallen numerous times. He might have bumped into some people that weren't quite so patient with a blind man. He may have been distracted by some who decided to take it out on him for getting mixed up in a crowd when he can't even see his way. And on top of that, having mud caked in his eyes and that liquid substance dripping down his cheeks while walking through the crowd, he must have been a sight. And I suppose that if anybody in Jerusalem at the time had ever seen a Hollywood zombie movie, they might have wondered, is this guy living or is he dead? But Jesus purposely directed the blind man to that pool. Even though a crowd had gathered for the festival, as many of them were probably wondering, quite curiously, what is this blind man doing with all that mud on his face? And then as they watched longer and they saw the man go down to the Pool of Siloam after he had washed off the mud, the man probably was quite a bigger sight to witness after having received his sight for the first time ever. You can look on the internet and you can see the faces of babies who have been given their hearing for the first time. The expressions on their faces are just marvelous. And there have been people who have received their sight for the first time. And when the device, when the bandages are peeled off and they are able to see, having had their optic nerve reattached or some other procedure, it's just hard to describe the elation that is felt. And so the people that must have witnessed this blind man having washed the clay out of his eyes there in the Pool of Siloam, that man with the muddy face, he would have been a walking billboard for the grace of God. He would have been a flashing sign saying, you better follow me because I'm going back to see the guy that did this. So many people would have witnessed this miracle, especially everybody that had gone to see this man laying in a public place, begging alms. It immediately caught the attention of the religious leaders, who promptly launched an inquisition. Why, if anyone claimed that Jesus had performed such a miracle, they didn't want that word getting out. Jesus was nothing but a wildcat heretic trying to set Rome against the city of Jerusalem by claiming to be a competitor against Caesar in Rome. They had to be just as dumbfounded by this man's healing as anyone else that saw it happen. No one had ever been healed who was born blind. In writing about this event, John the apostle mentioned the word blind 13 times in the chapter. And it was for important readers because it was necessary for his readers to understand the condition of the man prior to Jesus having healed him. It was noted 5 times in John's account that the man was blind from birth. And those words were mentioned to underscore just how miraculous Jesus' healing of this man was. The leaders of the Jews didn't believe that Jesus could heal the blind. So they didn't believe the man who had claimed to have been blind and then healed. They certainly didn't believe that he had been born blind, so they called the man's parents and they asked them, saying, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" The parents of the blind man confirmed that he was indeed born blind. And if they knew Jesus, they didn't want to admit that they knew him or believed in him. So in John chapter 9, verse 20 and 21, his parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes? We do not know. He's of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself. Now, if you keep reading John's account, you'll learn why the parents were a little hesitant to take a stand on what they knew about the facts of Jesus. The scribes and Pharisees wanted to label Jesus as a false prophet, as a deceiver, and they used every tool that they had, including, he doesn't keep the Sabbath day like we do, so he must be a sinner man. When the leaders called in the man's parents in an attempt to falsify the healing, the parents answered, we know this is our son, we know he was born blind, but we have no idea why he is now able to see. We don't know who did it or anything about it. Ask him. But when you look at verse 22, chapter 9, their evasive answers stemmed from their fear of the Jewish leaders. The leaders of the synagogue had threatened to excommunicate anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Christ, or for that matter, were his disciples. The interrogation of the blind man's parents, the man who once was blind, and then later Jesus himself, shows without a doubt that the Pharisees, like a lot of people today, had questions that were pretty hard to find answers that would fit with their worldview. So many of the Pharisees probably wondered, was the blind man really blind, even though everybody says he was? Even his parents, two of them, testified that he was born blind, but they could have been conspiring with Jesus. If the man really was blind, maybe it was just a temporary blindness and his sight would have returned on its own. Or if this really was a miraculous healing, how did it really happen? If a healing had occurred and Jesus was the one that did it, it could not be by the power of God, because Jesus is a sinner. The reason it was so hard for the Pharisees to find answers to their satisfaction was because they were so hateful toward Jesus, partly because he opposed them, partly because he pointed out their hypocrisy, and mostly because they were evil and Jesus was good, and they hated Jesus because in the battle between good and evil, evil is always jealous and hateful toward goodness. Besides that, the Pharisees didn't want Jesus to grow in popularity any more than he had already grown. They certainly didn't want Jesus displacing them from their power of authority over Judea and the whole Jewish nation. So the Jewish leaders attempted to discredit the Son of God, much like people will try to discredit the Bible today when they find something about it that just doesn't set well with what they want to believe. So in John chapter 9 and verse 24, the Jewish leaders dug in their heels. We know that this man is a sinner. Well, how did they know that? In our modern proliferation of knowledge, and there's so much of it, did you know that the English language has almost 1 million words now? Most of us might only use 2,000 words with any frequency. But language has become so large that one volume of a dictionary can't hold it all. It's because there's just too much knowledge in the world to communicate about any specific area. But in that knowledge that we have gained today, there is even a field of study about how to know anything for sure. It's called epistemology. How do you know what you know with any degree of certainty? Maybe what you know is just based on your opinions or your limited perspective in life, and what you think you know isn't really true. That's the ideas behind that field of study. So how do we know what we know for sure? And that field of epistemology, which is the investigation of accepting something that is true based on the evidence rather than on what our beliefs are, such as an opinion that may or may not be true. How did the Jewish leaders come to know for sure that Jesus was a sinner? Did they have multiple witnesses that testified in a court a duly authorized court of law based on the Jewish standard of law and evidence, and those witnesses agreed that they observed Jesus to have violated some commandment that the law of Moses said, you better not do this? Or did they know that Jesus was a sinner because they said he was a sinner, and that's all the evidence they needed? The man that was healed from his blindness spoke up during this inquisition, and he said, whether he's a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see. And he knew that for sure, because he couldn't see before. He was born that way. The first time he ever saw was when he did what Jesus told him to do. This previously blind man that had been healed from his blindness had experienced darkness for a long time. And when he met Jesus, he saw the light, literally. He was blind, he met Jesus, then he could see. It was pretty easy for him to put those facts together, and it wasn't just an opinion. He had measurable facts, things that were true that he could base his experience on, that confirmed his experience. But that didn't resolve the issue for the religious leaders, because they retorted, we know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he is from. They would never be able to answer that question. The answer to that question was so far out of their reach, they would never learn where Jesus was from until their blindness could be healed. The formerly blind man stated in John chapter 9 and verse 31, we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Though he was blind from birth, he apparently was able to hear and able to remember, and he must have heard those words read on the Sabbath day in the synagogue. Reading from the Psalms was quite popular in those days, and it's written in Psalm chapter 34, or Psalm 34, verses 15 and 16. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil. But did the psalmist mean all sinners, or just those who wouldn't repent? You see, the Bible tells about several sinners to whom God listened, but they were in a different category than most other sinners. You see, the sinners that were in Nineveh, they heard Jonah preaching, in 40 days, God is going to bring judgment on the city of Nineveh. And the message got all the way to the king of Nineveh, and he declared a citywide fast, and everyone prayed that God would relent. And the people of Nineveh prayed that Nineveh might be spared, and God answered their prayer and did not destroy the city of that Jonah had been preaching against. The Ninevites were sinners. In fact, they were really bad sinners based on some of the contemporary reports about the things that the Ninevites were doing. They were extremely violent. And as to whether or not they repented, well, at least for the period of fasting, it seems that there was a change in their hearts. There was a time when Hagar asked God to protect her son Ishmael. Now, you might recall that Hagar was the handmaiden of Abraham's wife, Sarai. I don't really know a lot about Hagar, but her name is Assyrian. It's quite possible that she was purchased or was given in settling of a debt. It's impossible for us to know because there's nothing revealed about it, where she came from, but her name implies a different belief system than Sarai herself. And yet, when she prayed that God would protect her son Ishmael, and by the way, she was not the mother of the promised child. She was the mother of the bond child. And God not only heard her prayer, but protected Ishmael and even and blessed him exceedingly. Ahab, I suppose you could prove that he was a sinner. He married a foreign woman. he paid for the sustenance of at least 400 prophets of Baal who ate at his own table. And of course, his wife, being a worshiper of Baal, brought Baal into the king's house and into the place of worship where the Israelites worshiped. But when you read in 1 Kings chapter 21, especially in verses 27 through 29, you see that after Elijah had prophesied concerning Ahab and his posterity, Ahab repented. And he prayed to God, and God responded by not bringing the calamity that had formerly been issued by the words of the prophet, certainly not during Ahab's reign. But there was this Gentile woman from Tyre and Sidon. She prayed that Jesus would deliver her daughter from a demon in Mark chapter 7. Jesus cast the demon out of the woman's daughter. And there have been many others who were sinners, whose sins they were still accountable for, to include Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. Even after the Holy Spirit had fell on Cornelius and his household, Peter still commanded them to be baptized, and the reason for baptism in Acts chapter 2 was for the remission of sins. So it seems that there were sinners there in Caesarea that God heard their prayers. But that ignorant blind man who thought that God didn't hear sinners was really saying, if Jesus was an unrepentant sinner, God would certainly not give him the power to perform miracles. The blind man said, since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. Jesus had clearly done something that people believed only the Messiah that had come from God would be able to do. It was one of the signs that the prophets in the Old Testament had said, when this guy comes, he's going to open the eyes of the blind. And the Pharisees were so determined that Jesus was not the Messiah that they were willing to deny the words of the prophets. They were willing to lambaste everything that Jesus had done. They were willing to dig in with their foregone irrational conclusion established on their mistaken idea about how they kept the Sabbath was the only way to keep the Sabbath. This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. Those were their words. And I can see them saying, he doesn't keep the Sabbath, not like us. And because he doesn't do it like us, then he's not keeping the Sabbath at all. We're the righteous ones, and we know that because we say so. And we're the boss of everybody. That was the kind of rationale that those men used. That put the Pharisees in a very, very precarious position and was going to keep them from finding the answers to their most difficult questions. They were so convinced that Jesus was not the Messiah that he was instead a blasphemer and a false prophet and a deceiver and a heretic, that they would not allow themselves to see anything that Jesus did in any kind of good light. You talk about being blind. They had eyes, but they couldn't see. They had ears, but they couldn't hear. And they couldn't remember. About the only thing that worked on these Pharisees was their mouths. No eyes, no ears, just mouths. A person doesn't have to know anything factual to be able to use one's mouth. Lots of people prove that every day. Abraham Lincoln once said, it's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt. The Pharisees opened their mouths and they removed all doubt. They weren't interested in truth except the truth that they declared to be true. And that is a dangerous position to be in. It prevents anyone from seeing any kind of factual information in its true light. They remained content to believe the lies they told themselves, and their minds would never be changed by the number of facts that might be presented to the contrary. Unfortunately, for some who are never satisfied with the truth, they are resigned to forever be doubting. I doubt that what you say is true because I have a different view. And they're like Pilate, who once said, "What is truth?" trying to evade the real truth, assuming there's no such thing as concrete truth and that it changes from time to time for any one person or the next. And so the Pharisees shared a trait with the apostatizers that the Apostle Paul wrote about in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 7, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. What was it they were learning if it wasn't the truth? Oh, it might have been some truth that they wanted. It might have been the truth that was helpful to them. It might have been truth that they thought made them feel good or gave them an air of pride. The result of not accepting truth is far-reaching and long-lasting. Those who were never able to bring themselves to know the truth were described by the Apostle Paul earlier in the chapter, in verses 2 through 5, as lovers of themselves. Lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, the very thing they accused Jesus of being, disobedient to parents. And that whole idea of Corban that the Pharisees had invented was so that they wouldn't have to obey their parents and care for them. They were unthankful and unholy and unloving and unforgiving and slanderers. And they had a lot of bad things to say about Jesus. They were without self-control and brutal. Look at what they had done to Jesus on the cross. They were despisers of good. They despised the Son of God. They were traitors and headstrong and haughty and lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. For if they were lovers of God, they would have loved His Son instead of having Him put to death. And verse 5 is the real telltale sign. They had a form of godliness, but denied its power. The Apostle Paul told Timothy to turn away from those who claimed to be righteous, even claimed to be Christians, but instead followed the path of self-interest to the point of denying God's power. Oh, but how would any of us ever deny the power of God? Well, you know, if we read something about the need to help the poor, but we say that the poor brought it on themselves and they're just paying for their sins, then maybe we're denying the power of God, certainly by denying Him our devotion and obedience. But the Pharisees and the scribes who rejected Jesus also made enemies out of anyone with whom they disagreed. They didn't just hate Jesus, they hated everybody that loved Jesus. And following their unsuccessful attempt to prove that no miracle had occurred, the exasperated leaders had heard enough from the man's parents, from Jesus, and even from the blind man. They threw the formerly blind man out of the temple. Probably not literally, but maybe literally. John 9, verse 34, they answered and said to him, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. Those words, cast him out, probably has to do with cast him out of their fellowship and out of the fellowship of the community. They excommunicated the man from their society so that he could not have any common or familiar interaction with anyone in that society. And that included all of Jewish society, those who were ruled by the synagogue and the Sanhedrin. This blind man, who could not previously engage in commerce because of his blindness, now had been healed, and he would have been able to engage in commerce because he was able, but now he has been put in the place by the leaders of the Jews that he will just have to starve to death or live among the Gentiles. He'd been cast out of the fellowship of the Jews. He'd be treated as a heathen man. No one could have him under their roof, including the parents or his relatives. No one could eat with him, including his parents or his relatives, or even touch him, lest they also become unclean. But in what transpired, another question rises that is even more important. How do you know what you know? if there is more to man than just the material aspects that we have, including our five senses. Our five senses are not actually completely able to discern all the truth, such as the truth that emanates from a spiritual realm where our senses have no effect at all. Learn how the blind man was able to see beyond his physical existence when he was approached by Jesus. John 9, verse 35. Jesus heard that they cast him out. And when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Then he said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. True spiritual knowledge comes when Jesus opens our eyes. I don't know exactly how that happens, but I know that everybody that reads the Bible, they don't believe. Their eyes aren't opened. Some people read the Bible like it's a history book or it's written by some man, and therefore it's no better than anything they might have written themselves.
Mercy.
But I know that the deception of sin will keep us from knowing the truth because of its blinding effect, as was experienced by the Pharisees. And when we come to know Jesus as the Son of God, we are so convinced that he is the only one who is worth our worship that we will give it to no other, to include ourselves. In times past, there have been mighty leaders among the churches, some denominations, some that were coming out of denominations, to express even serious doubts. And men like Martin Luther, Charles Spurgeon, C.S. Lewis, and I suspect a whole lot of others that didn't write about their doubts, expressed them. And as far as having more questions than answers, these men learned that seeking helpful answers are more important than just seeking answers for the sake of knowing. What good is it to know if that knowledge has no lasting benefit? It may be that curiosity seekers will find answers that scratch some itch. But those who seek the Lord seek something that is far more soothing and not nearly so temporary. Every time we turn the page of God's Word, we find another answer to a question that we should have been asking instead. And our faith, therefore, is right out in front of everybody who may have doubts. And when we allow our faith to be opened up for examination, just like in that interrogation of the man who was healed from his blindness, then others might benefit from the questions that they've asked and the answers that they have not yet found. That kind of faith grows to be far more certain, and our walk with God becomes sweeter and dearer than just searching the pages of the Bible for an answer that has no consequence. There are so many questions that I don't know the answers to. But if I was able to find all the answers to all my questions, compared to knowing Jesus Christ, those other questions are completely unimportant. In that sense, Jesus is the answer, whether or not a person has asked the question or not. But if a person's most important question in life is, who should I marry, or what career do I want, or where should I live, or how much money should I save before I retire, that's being a little short-sighted when it comes to asking the right answer, or asking the right questions. It's like my old agriculture teacher once said, "If you shoot for the barn and you miss, you might end up in the cow dung. But if you shoot for the moon and you miss, you'll still be among the stars." That means that we should look for the loftier answers with questions that are of much greater import. Some questions in life are more important than others, such as, What must I do to be saved? Or how can I make it to heaven? Answering questions like those will have a far greater impact on all of our lives. And they are similar to the question, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? If you do, then you'll worship Him and you'll obey Him. If you're unsaved, you need to answer that question. And if you're saved, keep believing it and ask the questions, Lord, what would you have me to do? The invitation song has been announced, and I don't see anyone that hasn't responded to the gospel, but if there's any way that we may assist anyone here tonight, make your desires known while we stand and sing this song of encouragement.